market.
The S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that, like the market, has started November with a bang. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, Dr. Anirban Mahati. How are you, Doc?
I'm fantastic.
Fantastic.
I'm great.
Wonderful, mate. That's exciting. Is it because the Blues won last night?
I know. I don't care who won.
Come on. It's Thursday morning, the 12th of November, as we always record, or usually record on Thursdays. And the Blues did win last night, squaring up the State of Origin series. And frankly, that makes things pretty good. We do have a question a little bit later regarding State of Origin. Go the Blues. Exactly. There
okay.
you go.
Well, I would like the Greens to win, not the Blues.
Better play State of Origin, dude.
But that's okay. I'm a green fan, not a blue fan. If I'm put it this way, I'm in a controversial mood today. So we'll see how we go.
Strap yourselves in, Phil. This is going to be a big one. And a quick apology from me for last week's podcast getting out late too. By the way, miscommunication with the guys at Triple M. Completely my fault, but we end up having the podcast out late. So thank you to those who contacted us. We did realize by Saturday, but I did the right thing. I gave the Triple M guys the weekend off. I didn't give them any grief, and we fixed it on Monday morning. So thank you for being patient. But we're back, hopefully. I won't say we're back to schedule, because if I mess it up again, then this will go out Monday again and I'll look like a dill. But hopefully this will go out on schedule.
Well, I'll start off by saying I had nothing to do with that. So I bear no responsibility.
Exactly. That's
my controversy number one.
That's the problem. That's why if you had something to do with it, maybe it'd be done okay. So really, it is your fault.
Well, it's not.
All right, let's get on with it. We've got a big, big docket, a big macro docket in particular today, but some company news as well. Speaking of going green, we've got a little bit of green coming up later in the podcast. Let's kick it off, mate. Let's not go too tangential, although we've probably already missed that boat. This has been an astonishing start to the month of December. It seems that
December?
Did I say December?
Yes.
Oh, November.
Yeah, November.
November.
You're not time traveling ahead.
Uma. That's one of those things.
Okay. All right. So just correcting you, it's November.
Gee, it's a tough start. All right. Should we start again? Ready? We'll edit that bit.
Well, it's in November, and it's a good start to November. Let's go from there.
All right, good. Here we go. Largely, it seems that those who like to try and apply reasoning to this in hindsight, the old Monday morning quarterback, saying it's the US election, it seems to have done most of the work. The ASX, as of I think yesterday, the day before, was up 7.5% in the month of November alone. Now, my usual refrain is that's about 75% of the average year on the ASX. So that is a phenomenal return in a week and a half on the market. Of course, this has been anything but a normal year. So I think we can necessarily take anything to the bank. We are getting close, though, to that ASX high of February. We know US markets are already on top of that number. This market seems to have thrown caution to the wind. It doesn't seem any other way to describe it. Now, of course, we've got the Biden presidency, the vaccine news, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Those things have kind of come out during the process. What's going on? Is this the market finally giving up on pessimism? Is it a case of trying to find some good news? Is the good news good enough to really see the market up 7.5% in a week?
Okay, so, as I said, I'm in a controversial mood, right?
Dear.
So, and I did some homework for a change yesterday.
Do I have to apologize now or later?
I'll just correct you on the way as we go. Any data point that I have done actually some work on. So yesterday, for example, I looked up the 10-year returns of the ASX as defined by the ASX 300 ETF.
The 300, okay, right.
The Vanguard.
ETF, yep.
And the reason I did that is, you can't invest in the all ordinaries because there is no such instrument to instrument it. And the ASX 300 ETF, the Vanguard one.
It's as close as we can get to the all ords, isn't it?
It's as close as you can get.
Yeah.
That has returned over the last 10 years.
Yes.
7.4% per annum. In other words, we got the full year's return in 1 week.
That's phenomenal.
Phenomenal.
There you go. Right? You have done some homework. I like that.
Yeah. So that's fantastic. Well, the bad news then. The bad news then is that for the rest of the year, we're going to get nothing.
Well, you'd be tempted to think that, except this year has been all over the place. January to February 19 was a great month and a half. February 19 to March 23 was the worst, quickest bear market in history. The recovery is also the quickest recovery from a bear market in history. And now, a month and a bit out from the end of the year, we're up 7.5% in a week. I don't know. I'd necessarily want to think that between here and December 31, the market result is zero. Are you making that bet?
I'm saying it's two steps forward, one step backwards. Two steps forward, one step backwards. Okay. It's still going forward.
Right.
That's fine. it's all over the place. But yeah, it's. I think that contextualization is good, right? You get the entire year's return that you've historically got the last decade. You got that in a week. So maybe the market is mad. Maybe the market is not mad. I don't know. But Yeah, something
it's
to...
It's a hell of a thing.
Yeah, it's a hell of a
nice
thing.
Nice research, dude. Don't set expectations that we're going to... So just be clear, there probably won't be any research done next week. Is that right, or are you going to do
some? That's probably true. Yeah. I just do it once a year.
There you go. Congratulations, Fools. You've listened to the right podcast, because this is the research podcast. It's 2020 will be one of those years that I think we look back for a long time and kind of marvel at just kind of what did go on over that space of 12 months. You said two steps forward, one step back, mate. So let me ask you. The US market's up, 15-odd% above its all-time high?
Yeah. So, like that, again, the US market as defined by the S&P 500?
Yep. Yes.
Yeah, it's up something like that.
So the ASX is close and has come back a long, long way. The S&P is up and hitting all-time highs in the midst. I mean, they are still getting 100,000 cases a day, right? So this is not, I think in Australia we can be tempted to believe we're kind of at the back end of the crisis. And frankly, we'll get to the vaccine in a second, but maybe we are, almost by virtue of the fact that maybe there is a vaccine, and so that does, to some degree, herald the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning. But even still, the market was not far from that pre-November 1. Is this reasonable, rational behaviour? I was a huge, huge, huge bull in March, right? I was saying to people, look, keep investing, keep investing, keep investing. This will come back. Things will turn around. It'll be fine. I had a question on Twitter, though, during the week, to the extent that, okay, fine, Scott, we get that. Agreed. But now we're here. Should you be setting all-time records in the midst of a pandemic? Is it reasonable to be paying, as much for stocks as we ever have in the US, more than that, almost as much in Australia, and yet still be in the midst of economic and health uncertainty?
Yeah, okay. Well, this is a more opportunity to be controversial here. Okay. So I did some research.
You're enjoying this, aren't you?
I did some research, as I said yesterday.
More research.
Right, yeah. So the S&P 500 over the last decade has returned about 12.4%. That's a full 5% ahead of the ASX.
In
right?
US dollars, just to be clear?
Actually, that part I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, that's right.
But let's say this is normalized.
Yep.
Because it actually should be an AUD.
Okay.
Because I compared both, and then you're going to get normalized results.
So not that it matters necessarily. I just want to be.
But let's say an AUD, right? For an Australian investor, actually, that's more relevant than anything else, right? So, five percentage points ahead, or 4.5 percentage points ahead. So that's a significant difference over a decade.
Certainly is.
Now. There is a tendency, this is a human tendency, for us to think about the pandemic.
Yes.
Then think about, so we think about many different things, and then I think we conflate them. So let me try to help people out, or this is how I think about them. We would think more cases is bad. Well, they are bad for humanity.
Yes. Right? I think we can agree on that at least.
We can agree on that.
Health-wise, yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then we might look at things like, our GDP is growing, and we can be very happy. Oh, we are out of recession. I would put a big question mark on that.
Okay.
Right? Is that is relevant again from a happiness quotient point of view.
Yes.
Has got nothing, in my view, to do with investing.
Okay.
Right? Or very little to do with investing.
Tell me why.
Okay, let me explain that. First of all, the economy as measured by GDP this is the most, what I call the fake number,
right?
So the government can throw stimulus, any government can throw stimulus, and I'm not saying the government as in our government, any government, all governments
have
thrown stimulus.
Yes.
You throw stimulus, you give people free money, they spend it, it looks like the economy is growing. Boom! Awesome, right? Well, but then you look at the employment numbers, and boom, they're not improving,
right?
In fact, they look horrible. They're better, but they're still horrible, right? That's one part of it. The second part, I think, is you have to think about where the employment numbers are coming from. If the employment numbers are coming from small businesses, well, those are not businesses that are listed anyways, right? The third point to consider is think about what you're investing in.
Okay.
So if you invest, for example, in the ASX 300, then you have made a bet on banks and miners, right? I can almost write it down on a piece of paper with no guarantees on it.
That's a controversial part.
No guarantees, because I refuse to give guarantees about anything.
Nor are we allowed to, by the way. So
nobody's
ASIC's
allowed to.
Very happy with that.
Well, not just ASIC, but I mean, why would I give any guarantees for anything? This is a free podcast.
I know.
If you're investing in banks as an example, and economy that is tied, or companies that are tied to the banks or the banking economy as such, then how do you expect you're going to get growth, right? Via asset price, mostly via asset price inflation, right?
Yep.
you know, Australia is not going to grow at like 20% per year to give the banks a growth of 20% per year. In fact, almost by definition, you should see contraction as things normalize, right? Because that spending dollars that have been being spent here is going to be spent elsewhere. So I think it's a there is a difference between case counts and you know, GDP numbers and everything else versus investing. Right, because you could invest in companies. Now, at the same time, it's also worth pointing out that, and we'll talk more about this as a third point. This is again a larger thing to think about. People should think about. Well, you know, we had World War II, huge big event, dislocative event. It resulted in balance of powers changing. It resulted in, you know, a lot of innovation that came out of World War, and those have flown through over time, or you know, right. I like to say, and I say this to the team, that in my mind, 2020 has seen some of the most and the biggest innovations of our time.
Okay.
Right.
Interesting. That's a big call.
Well, but yeah, that's the big call, right? Yeah. But you have to invest according to that big call, right?
Right, okay,
so,
yeah.
For example, number one, think about it this way.
Yep.
Because of the pandemic, irrespective of the fact that there are millions of cases in the US, right, and in Europe, what has taken hold is digital economy.
Yep.
Digitization has taken speed.
Yep.
Well, that digitization is not going to benefit Commonwealth Bank or NAB. They're going to be users of digitization. Mm-hmm. That's going to help them with their costs, but they are not the innovators of digitization, right? And therefore, that benefit flows elsewhere. Find those digital companies that are enabling that, right? So there's a huge push towards digitization, which was going at a certain rate, is now going to expand at a different rate.
Okay.
All right, that's number one. Number two, if you think about, if you get an abstract, you know, think about how space travel was happening. This is also the year where, you know, space travel is essentially, human space travel is back.
Okay. So travel, talking about just going to space, right? Not Mars, but just the idea of getting back into space.
What I'm talking about is, if you think about the step changes, if you abstract out everything and just think about the step changes in innovation, then you'd see that, you know, well, the Americans were not going, there was no Western aircraft that was, spacecraft that was taking people to the International Space Station. Well, that has been realized this year. Right. Now, of course, it's a culmination of effort for many years, but it did happen this year, right? This is also the year where electric vehicle sales have been growing compared to gas vehicle sales, right? So there's that thing. There's a sustainable transport revolution that's happening. There's digitization, of course, that we have talked about. The online penetration has gone up.
Yes, hugely.
Right? Hugely. So it's a year where a lot of disruption has happened to the common person, yet some businesses have performed like nothing has happened and, in fact, are speeding up.
Right.
And therefore, as investors, we need to watch for that. Think about that for a second.
Can I not challenge that, actually, just give some extra context. I mentioned... Was it you guys in the call? I can't remember yesterday. Anyway, I was talking to someone in the team. During the GFC, businesses like Apple kept growing because it was simply growing adoption and people wanted its products. On the other hand, we had businesses like Automotive Holdings, the car dealership, and Flexi Group, the debt provider, that grew because they were small and just simply growing into bigger markets. They were taking share even if the markets themselves were declining. That's one version of growth. And then there's another version of growth that is, to some degree, either take advantage of the pandemic, growing despite the pandemic, or something else. The businesses you're talking about now, which bracket do they fit in?
Well, I'm talking about secular long-term growth. What I'm saying is that we are at a phase where, you know, you might see online sales, for example, drop post, you know, opening of the economy.
You think, but we almost should, shouldn't we?
Yeah, they will.
It's so hot.
But that trend of uptake is going to continue.
Yeah.
Then we can ask the question, well, where is that? You know, who is going to win and who is going to get benefit from that, right? Anybody can open an online store. So therefore, you would think marginal competition would mean, well, every retailer is going to fight over online sales. They shouldn't really, their penetration of online increases at the cost of their offline sales, but they're all going to be fighting on the marginal dollars, right?
Yep.
There's not much gain then, in some sense, to be made there, if you think about it in that fashion. Then you can go down the protocol stack.
I mean, a bit of gain for the individual retailers, of course, but not from the online retail.
I'm talking the big winners, right? I mean, where is the big winner? The big winner is going to be, in some form, enablers of those technology.
Right.
Right? So, or enablers of those platforms. Yep. So this is at least how I think about my investing is... I want to think about those things that are driving, you know, I don't want to think about what's happening. The GDP number went up, down, corona case count is this. Those things are almost immaterial. Right. It's just like hundreds of thousands of people died in, and it sounds insensitive, hundreds of thousands of people died in World War. Well, Yes. But if I am just thinking, because I'm not a policymaker, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be making policy decisions. Mm-hmm. I'm not an economist.
Right.
And I'm not the queen to make people feel good, right? Right? Or the king.
We're all happy about that for different reasons. Yes.
So like, you know, it's different people have different roles. My mm-hmm. role is to just find investments. Right. And from an investment point of view, focusing on the big picture and the big winning things helps, right? Everything else then becomes a sideshow. Yep. As it's a very, you know, this might sound like, you know, it's a very cold-blooded, you know, mercenary-style approach to investing, but it is, like, you know.
I would say that if you want to say that. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, but I mean, mercenary-style investing. No, I'm focusing on the underlying underpinnings. Which
as an individual investor, you know, and you can actually have both views at the same time. We can have a policy view, an economic view, a macro view.
Absolutely.
And we can also choose what to do with our money. And those things.
But never confuse economic, you know, your social view, your economic view, your political view has nothing to do with your investing. And this is very important to keep in mind, because people, I think, conflate these two.
Yep.
And they think, oh, you know, this is great and that is great. Yep. And, you know, this is awesome. And therefore, I'm going to invest in CBA.
Yes.
Well, kind of, if you know, you're not really helping yourself with doing that. You know. You want to help yourself. So So I think, you know, I think to me, actually, it looks like, irrespective of the market, the market is going to do a lot of things in the short term, as you said, you know, 7% up, down. But I think there are a lot of opportunities, you know, if I have to leave it on an optimistic note, I think there are a lot of opportunities if you want to think about what has started, what was ongoing already, and where the value would be accreting, right? And you want to think about value accretion, and most of that value accretion is actually in technology and new age things, not in old age things, right? Yep. So I think that's what I'm going to leave thought with.
I like that. I like the separation, mate. I think we have a lot of people, particularly people who want better things in the world, who confuse the two, and I think there's. You know, I've banged on many, many times about ethical investing. We had one more listener email me tweeted me during the week about ethical investing. It's that same idea, right? You can hope that people take action on ethical investing. You can hope that people change the world, but if they're not going to, then there's no point investing in it. Conversely, ethical investing itself, while you kind of hope desperately that you could do something investing-wise to make a difference, the chance you actually can is still remote. And so wishing it was so doesn't make it the right way to invest, as you say. Whichever direction you take this thinking, whether it's, you know, as you say, whatever you hope the economy does or doesn't do, whatever the economy actually does or doesn't do, they are different things from how you invest your money for maximum benefit. And I think that's a really important point. I will say, for what it's worth, I think there's still different ways of making money in the same context. And this is really a question of, as you said, how you put that money to work in a way that makes just maximum sense for your portfolio. I think, you know, if you are an ETF investor, then the market does matter a hell of a lot. If you own the banks, then you really should care about what the economy is doing, not necessarily because, not what the economy should do, but if you own businesses that are exposed to the economy, you want to be really clear that you have a very strong thesis for it. And again, as we've talked about before, commodity companies in particular, and again, when I say commodities, I mean in the broadest sense, airline seats, oil, gold, you know, whatever wheat, whatever you're doing, you need to understand the impacts or the areas of influence that will change your business's fortunes. And as Doc says, whether they are big, long-term, you know, kind of technological changes, whether they are short-term economic impacts, whatever those things are, you really have to know what you're buying. You have to know how those businesses are impacted by the individual, you know, the things that do impact those businesses. Understand them really, really well, because that makes a huge difference. And that's where, you know, during the GFC, the banks struggled, but FlexiGroup grew. Same industry, same business, doing slightly different things, but, you know, effectively still in the credit provision business, but a very different part of the market. So really, really understanding what your company does, how it makes money, and what's likely to impact it, super, super important when it comes to trying to make sure you know what you're investing in and what sort of returns you're expecting. Any more on that, mate?
No.
That was a good conversation. That was, I have one bullet point on my thing. We didn't even get close to that. We got a million miles further, which was awesome. So let's try and drag ourselves desperately back to that. I'm going to ask you about some macro, despite your comment. You may choose to simply ignore it, but let's do it anyway. Consumer and business confidence was out during the week. Both numbers are up. I think it was, I'm going to confuse this. Now, I think it's business confidence is actually up higher than the survey average, higher than where it was 18 months ago, November 2018, higher than it was pre-pandemic. And it's tempting to look at that. We had a question. I've got a Bombay question for Sunday on exactly this topic, or at least the impact of it. It seems to me, and as you say, maybe it's fake, maybe it's entirely government generated, but these things do generate to some degree their own momentum, right? The more we spend, the more we hire, the more we spend. It is to some degree the entire intent of any stimulus package is to kickstart, you know, almost the crank turn the motor, to use the old school car terminology, although you probably don't appreciate that being an EV guy. You know, whatever the electronic version is of that kind of, you know, extra bit of boost to just get momentum moving forward. Those numbers, unquestionably good. I haven't seen a bad data point in about a month and a half.
Yeah, so the way I look at this is, like, suppose, you know, I'm a business owner. I look at those numbers and feel good about it because it means that my business can continue and I can make more money. From an investment point of view, I actually do not care about that at all, really. Largely because, again, as I've said before, these data points are, you know, they're not reflecting any normal, first of all. And the second thing is that, you know, most of this is a reflection of stimulus spend that's going into the small and medium scale enterprises. That is not really where you're investing in the stock market, right? I mean, in the stock market has, you know, you're not investing, yes, in your business, yes, but if you're an investor, it doesn't actually really matter, right? And in the long run, it's a bit like, you know, where you're spending the money. So if you, you know, if you put the money into the economy that resulted, you know, you give businesses, you know, tax breaks, they bought a ute or a car or something else, well, it's a one-time spend. It's really not, it's not in many ways, it is cycling the money, I get it, and but it is not doing anything fundamentally different. It's not really creating the next wave of whatever, right? So it's a bit like, I don't know, maybe this analogy doesn't hold, but, you know, it's a bit like, well, there's no climate emergency right now, so why bother about it, right? And life is good right now, so why bother about it? I think the fundamental problem for most,
to be really clear, you're not saying that's the case. I'm just for those listening, Doc is not saying we shouldn't care about it. You're saying you're promoting the contrast.
What I'm saying is that it appears that the air we breathe right now in Australia is very clean, so we shouldn't care, we shouldn't worry about it. But if we don't worry, then eventually in 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years, the air becomes polluted. The same thing is true for the way things are happening in the economy, right? This is why I'm not a proponent of, you know, the rate cuts, and I'm not a proponent of the way certain things, you know, I'm a proponent of helping immediately, which I've said, you know, I'm a proponent of, you know, immediate stimulus, but not ongoing stimulus. You know, as I was a proponent of an immediate lockdown, not of an ongoing lockdown, because I think you need to adapt with time and change your behavior. Because what you want to focus on is not the short-term win, but you want to focus on the long-term win, right? You want to focus on what's going to be good, not for us today, not just for our children, you know, in the next 20, 30 years, but for their children's children, right? This is really hard to do. And it is, you know, symptomatic of our desire and symptomatic also of, you know, what sort of innovation ecosystem you've got, right? So I bang on innovation for a reason is, you know, if you think about the world as a physical system, and the physical system has got chaos in it, you can find a local optimum or you can find a global optimum. By definition, the global optimum is always better than the local optimum, but it's much easier to solve for the local optimum. And therefore, we always have a tendency to solve for the local optimum, right?
Is it analogous? I'm not a systems thinker. I'm not an IT computer science PhD. Is there an element of kind of just the important and the urgent? You know, that kind of acronym of, you know, there's the important and the urgent, and we all tend to work on the urgent because it's urgent, and we kind of forget the important because we kind of want to get to that after the stuff that's urgent's out of the way. Is there any analogy there?
Well, it's true, right? And which is why I said that I'm a huge supporter of immediate action when you need to prevent a huge catastrophe, right? But then you can't continue on that sort of footpath because it's like, you know, you took a turn to the left because you had no other choice because every road was blocked. When the roads start unblocking, if that is the long winded road to nowhere, you just don't want to continue traveling on that path. That's the analogy. So, like,
there's time to backtrack and get back on the main road.
You want to get back to the main road. You want to find the high, you know, the high road to win over the long term. This is, we're investors for the long term. So, I mean, you know, again, you know, you could apply this sort of filter to businesses and apply this sort of filter to, you know, to collections of people over time. So, you know, what appears on the surface is bad may not be as bad, and what appears on the surface is good may not be as good, because again, there is a short term, a long term, and local optimal, global optimal sort of thing, right? So some of the things to think about. I try to invest with, you know, and I encourage people to, with a multi-decade sort of horizon. And in the meantime, I'm willing to take the volatility that comes with it. But part of the thinking behind a multi-decade investing horizon is the global, optimizing for global, you know, trying to find the global optimum is going to result in, you know, basically people, whatever people want, they want faster, better, cheaper, right? Whoever's going to deliver that, people are going to just take that.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah,
so faster, better, cheaper, as long as I can give you a better product, you're going to buy it. You're not going to care where it came from. You're just going to take it. So I think that's another way to think of it, you know, find the best products, services, and, you know, things that are delighting people and things that are changing the world, and then you'll be fine.
Very good. I like it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's go to some company specific stuff, because we had some really big numbers out today, and some of those numbers will potentially even be exemplars of the sort of discussion we've just been having. Saw some numbers at this point. Xero, the online cloud accounting software business, sales up 21% year on year. Bunnings, excluding Victoria, which is kind of one of those things I'm saying, except bad stuff, but work with me for a second. Excluding Victoria, Bunnings sales year to date up 29%. Now, we're used to 20% growth for software companies. So Xero sales, 20%, that's really impressive, right? It's big. It's done a whole lot of growth already. If you can still grow at that sort of rate, you're doing pretty well. When you get a hardware retailer growing effectively $1.03 that did last year, it's adding another dollar to that. And you know, that doesn't happen, right? We saw Woolies and Coles, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, up 10 and 12% respectively, or the other way around. Coles and Woolies up 10 and 12% respectively. Bunnings up 29%, Xero up 21%. Let's start with Xero. This is a business, so they had net additions were still up, but up by less. So this business is either slowing growth or losing more customers. I don't know if they were clear about which of those it is, but to some degree that's the case. Average revenue per user down 4%. So a really good opportunity, I think, to talk about. We talk, you know, about innovative businesses, software as a service businesses. Xero was probably the first one that Australians really cottoned onto to really kind of start to learn about software as a service, recurring revenue businesses. These things paying up for, frankly, for future growth. We, you know, Xero was the first to come off the rank on the ASX, plenty overseas, but Xero was the first one we kind of all started to take notice of. I'm impressed that the growth is still at 21%. That's a stunningly large number considering how big this business already is. If you can grow at that sort of rate, you're doing something right. On the other hand, some of the metrics that kind of matter, the number of customers it's adding is slowing. And again, maybe that is one-off business failures. But average revenue per user down 4%. That's the one I thought, hang on, if you want to kind of, you know, pick some metrics and work out which ones you want to be focusing on, customer additions make sense. And then how much those customers are paying you year on year also makes sense. So how do you pass the Xero results? Good top line, okay customer additions. Bad. I think it's just unquestionably bad. Average revenue per user falling. You never ever want to see that. Is this the last kind of, you know, sputtering bit of growth for Xero before it becomes a mature business? Is this pandemic related? Of course, we don't know for sure, but just give us your initial thoughts on the Xero result.
Yeah. So first, a caveat: I haven't actually looked at you know, below the surface other than
we should say it came out just before we started recording.
Yeah, so
Doc's not,
just,
that's
so I haven't had a look.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a position that we hold in one of our portfolios. So that's another disclosure item. So, like, here's the thing with Xero, right? It is not surprising that their, you know, net additions, you know, were relatively down compared to the other quarters, because they probably have had churn. Yeah. And you would expect churn because, you know, a bunch of small businesses. Like, if you had a cafe that was running with Xero that you had to close, or a restaurant, well, there's no reason for you to, you know, keep your Xero subscription, right? At that point, or after some, you know, after you reconciled your books, you probably had no reason to keep it. So I think that is understandable.
Mate, can I before you move on, just define our terms here for people who aren't used to this sort of business. When we say churn, we're talking about butter here. We're talking about the proportion of customers it keeps year on year. So I had 100 customers last year. It's got something less than that this year.
Yeah.
And that loss rate, the percentage loss is referred to in the industry as churn.
Yeah, yeah. So the number of people as a percentage that are leaving.
Nice.
The you know, the base, the customer base. Yep. And that's not surprising.
Yeah.
Churn, like as defined, as I just got this defined it, is for the type of businesses, Xero. So Xero is squarely focused on small to medium scale businesses, right? Mm. A huge big deal here in Australia and New Zealand. Both places had severe lockdowns, you know, stringent lockdowns, which basically means that, you know, there were businesses that actually went out of business. Yeah. And, you know, and therefore they might have discontinued their Xero. So I think, again, that, and then another thing to realize is SMBs anyways have a higher failure rate than larger companies, right?
And this is Xero's bread and butter, right? They're small and medium Xero's, companies.
Yeah, you're right. And this is Xero's bread and butter. Yeah. Again, nothing surprising there because, again, you'd expect that, you know, out of 10 cafes that are started, some are going to fail. It's just the definition of that type of business, right? It's just hard. So I think that's fine. The ARPU number, if I have to
can I ask a question about churn? And just for the sake of the fun of it, not surprising, they lose some customers, makes a whole lot of sense. Are we as investors sometimes guilty of looking at only the good times of lack of churn, you know, and then excusing the times when they fall? And again, not you, not about Xero, but just if I think about that, I think, you know, a bit like I said about Bunnings, right? And we'll get to Bunnings in a second. But, you know, sales were up, except in Melbourne where it sucked. And sometimes we kind of say, well, we had, Xero had 10 great years of growth, which time there was no economic challenges. And so, of course, I was going to get growth. And then we say, well, of course they lost customers because there was a pandemic and you expect that. Are we sometimes guilty of excusing businesses on both sides? We don't kind of handicap that growth. I will include banks in the same conversation, by the way. Banks never take bad debt allowances in advance when they should be taking them. And then it happens, we go, oh, who knew there could be a recession? And the honest answer for everyone should be, of course, we all should have expected it. Do we sometimes over-egg the success of businesses in the good times? And then try and explain away in the bad times, and maybe we should be a little more circumspect when things are obviously good, and so it's easy to sign up new customers.
Yeah, so I think that's a fair point. Like, the only thing I'll say in defense of a business like Xero is this, right? So their main competition really is legacy software, right? Yeah, so there'll be people who are using spreadsheets at home to their accounting. They're probably
dumping shoeboxes in some cases.
Yeah, they're literally dumping the files from their banks into a spreadsheet and then trying to do it. Or, you know, so it's a bit like. It's a bit like what we would say is the war on cash, right? Yeah. The war on cash, if you think about electronic payments, it's not the competition with other payment providers exists, but the real competition is with cash. Here, the real competition is with existing systems. So there's a runway for growth where, I mean, you could potentially get 15-20% growth for a long time because the share that you're trying to get from, you're trying to win from is just plenty.
Yeah, right?
And if you're not just talking about new business creation, there's always new business creation. So I think that's the differentiating aspect for business of this type. Most news, which is not the same for like a bank, a business like Bunnings or a business like CBA. Mm-hmm. Those are basically at the mature end of their life
cycle.
Hugely
mature,
right? So it's not that they can grow at 20% forever.
Right.
Whereas, I mean, nobody can grow for 20% forever, but like, I mean, if your market penetration is relatively small, you can grow at 15-20% for a long time, right? And as you grow, your delta cost for growing, you know, delta cost for running the software really does not grow at that rate, right? Yeah. So you become more and more profitable.
Awesome.
Yeah. So there's a good leverage there in the business where you start seeing more cash come to the shareholders. Yes. So putting that aside, I think the only other thing I'll say is the ARPU down.
Yes.
Again, I'm just making this up. So one possibility is that they might have got lots of people asking for deferral of payments.
Oh, okay.
Or they might have softened their payment terms, or they might have given longer, trial periods, which are all going to affect your ARPU.
Yeah, right. Makes sense.
So again, it's not. Is it great? No, but I'm. You know, the top line is still growing, which is good. And from the other important thing to realize with these type of businesses is that once they are in, it's hard to take out your business is surviving. That's number one. And number two is it's very recurring in that sense. And number two is that once they're in, the bigger promise really is, and if it materializes, is what else can they do, given that they're already embedded in your life, right? So what else, what other service can they provide? And that's where other growth opportunities come from, right?
Yep.
Most technology companies have that element of, I'm going to get in this way, I'm going to find a little door, then I'm going to get in, and then I'm going to grow. I'm going to just take over your life, right?
It's an interesting analogy, mate, because the times we're living in right now. But as you explain that, I'm thinking it's kind of like a virus. It kind of gets in the system and then kind of mutates from there, which is, you know, not a perfect. It has negative connotations, but that's not miles away. You've referred to it before as land and expand. The idea is you arrive somewhere and then you find new ways of helping that customer with other services either that you already have. You might acquire someone. You may add modules to your software in-house, and you're trying to basically, look, we've got this relationship. We're in your system, as you say already. Hey, let me make this easy for you. Why don't I add module X? It's part of your business process. It'll add nicely to what you're already using. It's a really nice model, and it's for a customer perspective. You're like, you know what? That really would make my life easier. Yeah, I'll pay you a bit more zero for this thing you're adding to my life.
Yeah, like so Xero, for example, starts by making your accounting easy, right? Mm-hmm. But if you've got employees, then you want to pay them. If you can integrate payments for your employees, well, that makes your life a little bit. Nobody wants to use 10 different disparate systems, right? And then suppose you've got timesheets that you want to, you know, you want to have your employees clock.
Yep.
Well, do you really want to use another timesheet that is, you know, you could potentially, that's part of the Xero ecosystem. Yep. But if it is built into Xero, it's just easier. It's like those sort of things, right?
Yeah, it makes
perfect sense. Again, as I said, it's all about, you know, it doesn't matter where it comes from. It's easier, better, and cheaper.
Yep.
People will use it.
And it just plugs in, which is the other thing. Like, you know, how many more systems you want to have to log into? It makes life easier. But I like that a lot. When it comes to Xero's kind of core business, we know that it's been, as you say, it's got a lot of business from there. And I'm curious as to your thoughts. This is just a random tangent, mate, a question without notice. You talk a lot about total addressable market and the ability for a business to grow. And you also then talk about Xero about, you know, it's kind of a disruptor in a very large market. I'm curious as to how you think, maybe they're just two completely separate questions. They don't even, you know, there's no overlap. But I'm thinking about a business that is creating a market for itself. So if I think about, I can't think of a great example right now. E-commerce, probably Amazon in the old days is probably, you know, creating a market for itself in some ways. iPhone's probably a better example, right? So there was this thing you used to carry around. It was a handset that made phone calls. Apple created the, you know, ultra personal computer, the ultra portable computer, literally the phone in the pocket, right? Which was a smart computer that happened to make phone calls. It created a market and then kind of grew that market. Someone like a Xero is kind of saying, well, there's a market already there. And yes, they've grown the market a little bit by saying to people, look, you were never going to go and buy a piece of software off the shelf. You got a shoebox full of receipts to give your accountant once every 3 months. Use this instead. So they are growing the market some ways. Do you have a preference as to, you know, I'm thinking, gee, if you knew there was a Xero type business out there that was disrupting an existing market that was already having success, that feels like a lower risk strategy, because you're not reliant on, hey, the market could be X size. You're like, no, I know how big the market is. It's this size. And Xero is taking share. For me, that's a lower upside potentially, although it depends how big the market is, but maybe potential lower upside. But it feels like a lower risk way to take advantage of disruptive growth when you kind of got this, you know, use the virus thing again, kind of, you know, slowly taking over the segment, the category, the industry. That to me feels like a less risky way to invest than saying, hey, this business over here is creating a brand new market we didn't have before. Netflix and streaming, maybe another one. Again, we had lots of other entertainment, so it's hard to, you know, there's always, every business always replaces the dollar spent on something, so nothing's completely new. Do you have a thought as to, you know, how you'd prefer to invest there, or how you think about those two types, or are they even different at all?
Well, in my mind, they're not really that different, because, like, okay. I mean, every business, as you rightly said, right, is replacing something. And then it replaces some. You can't replace something with exactly the same thing, right? Yeah. You replace something with, you know, as I said, smaller, faster, cheaper, better, and then that better becomes morphs itself over time. So the market sort of expands. You know, it's the so I think So like most companies will define their markets based on or market opportunity based on what they see currently in the system. So most software companies would define their, you know, if they're cloud-based, for example, modern software companies, they're going to define their opportunity in terms of, well, the legacy systems, the banks use COBOL with on-premise architectures. I could replace that. That market just for maintenance is that, but if it had to be replaced, it's like, what, $500 trillion? Well, that's my target market. Or if I'm going to target a small thing off that market, then it's that much, right? And it's tangible. So, you know, in some industries it's harder to take share, it takes time. In some industries it's easier to take share. There are industry dynamics involved, lots of different things
makes sense
to think about.
Makes sense. Very good. Thank you, mate. Wesfarmers, just quickly, or Bunnings in particular, you mentioned the fact this is kind of a one-off thing. These are obviously very different stories, and part of it is the beauty of software, right? The Xero gets a customer. That 21% growth in sales is largely because more customers are paid them more money, or in this case, a little bit less money. But generally speaking, more customers pay more money every month. And every new customer you sign up, you're probably keeping for X number of years. Bunnings, I mean, look, I probably spend more time in Bunnings than I should. My shopping is almost recurring revenue by definition. But for most people, you go to Bunnings every now and again when you want to. Bunnings doesn't get to sign me up for $10 a month for the next 15 years. You know, maybe I spend money there, maybe I don't. Maybe I go to the competitor. Maybe I stop, you know, I build my chicken coop at the done. I'm not going to go and buy more wood and build a second or a third chicken coop. But sales up 29%. I don't know if you agree, actually. I firmly believe this is the single best retailer in the country, at least based on its otherwise the metrics that already existed pre-pandemic. Returns on equity of 50%+ are just phenomenal. This is an absolute juggernaut. Does 29% growth not at least get you slightly interested in buying shares in a retailer?
No.
Tell me why not.
Well, as I said, right? I mean, Bunnings can grow next year this time.
Yep.
I want to see how much it grew, and I'm almost going to predict it's going to be down 5 to 10%,
yeah.
Easily, maybe more, yeah. Right? In terms of relative. So I mean, that's my thing with investing is I try to keep my investing simple. I want to find things that are in what I call secular growth. Mm. I want to find things that have long tailwinds, long journey that they can make, and I want companies that can transform themselves over time.
Yeah.
I am not interested in banks, retailers, traditional retailers, supermarkets, right, because they're just not that thing. And the beauty of investing in sort of growth is that most people do not think things can grow forever or for a long time, right? Mm. And that's huge. It's basically the easiest way. Mm. And I'm making it sound too simple, which is not really good, but it's the easiest way to make money. It's basically, everybody wants to invest in things that they can see. It's harder to invest in things that you can't see. It's harder to actually even think that something can grow at 20%+ for 15, 20 years, right? Nobody thinks like that.
Mm.
So, when I say nobody, very few. And that's an opportunity in my mind, yep. Right? So what appears to be overvalued today is actually really cheap, right? And with that sort of window and that sort of runway, you just need to be right some number of times.
Mm.
And you're set. Right, so it's a much easier. It's in my mind. It's an easier way to invest instead of trying to go in and out. Like, you know, you need to buy a well-established retailer at a good price, then sell it at a good price, then come back again. It's just too hard, and I just don't have that energy or the capacity or the ability to make those in and out decisions. Right, so I just say pass.
Makes sense. Yeah. Makes sense. But let's go. Let's go back to vaccine. So we're getting a bit macro here, but also I want to talk about what the market's been doing over the last couple of days. We saw vaccine news released by Pfizer. They're claiming a large sample size, large test group, 90% of efficacy, which is phenomenally large, bigger than the seasonal flu in terms of its ability to hopefully, touch wood, solve this particular pandemic and frankly find us a vaccine. Now, maybe others do as well, add to that mix, but at least for now, there's reason to believe, hopefully, Pfizer has a solution. Now, there's still some debate and uncertainty around the scientific community about, you know, some of the detail, and it's been done by press release rather than you know, published scientific research. There's a whole lot of stuff. So we don't want to over-egg this one, particularly as investors, because, frankly, the responses to this were all over the place. So we saw the market, the futures actually jumped pretty big. The US futures also jumped pretty big, with 3.5% they were before market traded. By close, the US market closed up, I'll say only, but only 1.4%, 1.6%. The Australian market actually closed up less than 1% on the day the news was announced. But that's kind of the proverbial duck that seems calm on top of the water and is going like mad underneath with legs kicking and carrying on, because we saw businesses like Westfield or Unibay Rodamco, Westfield as it is these days, shares were up 40%. The market was almost flat. We saw shares in Corporate Travel Management, I own shares, Webjet, I own shares, and Flight Centre, I don't own shares of those, up 15% each. We also saw Kogan down 18%, Temple and Webster down 20%, Redbubble, I can't remember, but 20%+ from memory. And again, oil was up 8%. The oil sector was up 8%. IT was down 6%. These are phenomenal. You know, individually, you go, wow, the market must have moved massively. And it didn't. I hate to use the phrase or the word rotation because it's one of those horrible cliches that we all hate, but it was hard to see that and think that there weren't a whole lot of people kind of flicking a switch in their portfolios and going, great, now we can get back into the stocks that we couldn't own previously, and we're getting out of the stuff we didn't really want to own because we had to own it because there was nowhere else to be. I won't even put words in your mouth. How do you think about that sort of stuff? Are they reasonable? Are there overreactions? Are there opportunities? Are there risks? When the market goes nowhere, but sectors literally fly to other ends of the spectrum, this is one of the strangest days on the market I've ever seen. Didn't get much commentary because the total market wasn't up much, but it was a really, really strange day.
Yeah, I have one word for that. I love it. I think it's fantastic. it's this myopia of the market, right? And short-sightedness of the market.
Totally.
That is really something that investors can leverage, right?
Yep.
I love it because here's the thing. I mean, on the surface,
yep,
some of these movements make sense. Like, you can justify it. You can try to justify it, right? So one way to justify it would be say, well, okay, all the spend that was, I'm going to use Kogan as an example, saying all the spend that was going to Kogan, now people are going to be less scared. There's going to be, everybody's going to be vaccinated and everybody's going to go back to wherever they were shopping, and therefore some of that shopping is going to disappear from Kogan.
Yeah.
Yes, that is obvious.
Yep.
That's probably what's going to happen.
Yep.
That does not, however, change the trajectory for Kogan the business over the next 10 years.
Right.
Right. Again, no, but there's no guarantees in this thing. There is a trajectory for online sales. There's a trajectory for, you know, Kogan's efficiencies to, for example, improve as more and more people use it.
Yeah.
It can leverage its distribution centers. It can leverage its buying power, and it can leverage its brand and the white label things that it sells to a larger population. Right, larger.
Yeah.
So none of those things have changed.
Yeah.
Yes, stuff might have temporarily changed, or in the short term, it maybe is not as attractive. I don't know. I'm not making that. I'm just saying that, yes, there's a justification.
Yeah, yeah.
But it misses that long-term picture, right? And then if it misses that long-term picture, that's the opportunity in my mind. The short-term reaction that people did is exactly what I talked about, right? That people want to make this, I'll use value for the lack of a better word, they're making this value call, right? Mm-hmm. That this is undervalued. In the short term, I'm going to get into this. That's going to then give me the opportunity I'm going to ride this recovery wave and then I'm going to get out at some point. Why? If everybody did that, a lot of the arbitrage that you had just disappeared.
It goes
away.
Correct.
You just, you know, Westfield or whatever, whatever it's now called, it just went up 40%. I don't know. Like, I mean, the person who bought at 40% plus, how much arbitrage is left out for them, right?
Exactly.
So that's the problem.
Yeah.
On the other hand, this thing that people dumped 20%, maybe arbitrage is on that end, right? Because it's now 20% cheaper. So that's the way I like to think about this. I don't worry about it at all.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter to me. So that, I think that's the pricing action behavior, right? The I don't know what else you were talking about. The vaccine, is that the other thing that you were talking about? Or?
Well, just more the move in the market. We'll talk about the vaccine in a second, actually. But the sense. Look, I have to say I find that the move's stupid, quite frankly, in the sense that it's not like there was some unknown outcome that all of a sudden, you know, if an alien landed and alien stocks went up, you go, okay, well, who knew that was going to happen? To some degree, for the market to have had Westfield 40% cheaper yesterday and 40% higher today on the use of a vaccine, you had to have almost believed, if that move is right, if yesterday's and today's price are both right, the only assumption I can draw is that people honestly thought we'd never get out of the house again.
Well, okay, can I challenge you on that a little
please.
Bit? So there is a little bit of, I think, validity to the move, you know, not the degree, I guess, but
that's
there's a little bit of validity, right? Because
absolutely.
For example, there was no vaccine news, and let's say we're going to be locked up and people are not going to go to the mall for next 1 year, 2 years.
Sure, sure.
Maybe there is in some sense, I don't know how much debt, for example, Westfield had. Maybe Westfield can actually go out of business, right?
Yeah.
So there's that risk.
Yes.
That risk became less.
Yes.
And, you know, in some future cash flows have now all of a sudden become visible.
Agreed.
And, you know, is it 20%? It's not definitely not 40%.
And that's my issue. It's not the move. If there'd been 3% moves either way, I'd be like, okay, that seems reasonable.
Okay.
As you say,
you
know, maybe Westfield opens in January rather than June.
Yeah.
And the profits,
and 5%, and then the stock goes up 5%.
Yeah, I'll say same with the travel company, same with Kogan, right? That both moves in both directions. Temple and Webster, the same thing. It's not like people thought, oh yeah, we'll always buy from Kogan or Temple and Webster and never go to JB Hi-Fi again.
Yeah.
Yes, it might have been 3 or 5 months earlier. Yes, that might be worth a few percentage points on some sort of discounted cash flow basis. Just bizarre to me that you can find a way to say this is a 40% difference or a 20% difference on the basis. I mean, in Australia in particular, where we're pretty much, most of us are back to normal-ish life. Victoria getting back to normal-ish life slower than the rest of us. But effectively, I mean, you know, I don't know. Just, it just strikes me that as bizarre, the sheer size of the moves. Actually, not the direction. I completely agree. The size was just phenomenal.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So let's go to the vaccine, man, only because this is a investing podcast. We do tend to tangent. We do tend to have a broad remit. We're gonna go even broader than normal here because you've been sharing some really kind of you've been pretty energetic about this, and it is the impressiveness of the potential vaccine and the technology behind it. Now, neither of us are medical doctors. Neither of us are biological scientists. You happen to be a computer scientist. You have a PhD, so you're miles ahead of me. But in any case, we're not going to try and cover this from a pure health perspective, and I don't know how closely or otherwise we'll go to the specifics of the science. But the very idea of the technology behind this is huge, and you've talked about that. It does make some impact on the investment markets because if this is the future, it is a step change and almost like a right angle turn in terms of the way a lot of our future medicinal compounds, vaccinations, a whole lot of other stuff gets made.
Yeah. So again, I don't know a whole lot of this. It's just, you know, and I don't invest based on what I have understood largely because, again, I might have missed something, right? So RNA basically is, you know, this ribonucleic acids. Everybody has, you know, we have DNA and RNA in our body, basically defines the genetics of our body.
Yep.
And okay, and then backtrack a little bit. The traditional flu vaccine, for example, basically involves finding the strains that we think are going to be there and taking weakened versions. This is how vaccines are made. Weakened versions of the germs, putting it into your body. That results in the body now knowing what germs to look for. Mm-hmm. Its immune system has been, it just gets programmed to attack it.
So it's a practice test, isn't it?
It's a practice test. And it's not 100% foolproof, but it makes, you know, even if you get the flu, you just get a weaker version of the flu as long as the correct variants or group of variants have been programmed. Traditionally, vaccines have been done that way.
Yeah.
Right? Now, what this one does is basically saying, well, what you want to do is you want the body's immune system to respond.
Mm.
Why do we have to input germs into your body? We're going to input the synthetic compound, which is called the messenger in this case, which is why it's called mRNA.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Know that.
And the messenger is going to go to the RNA and going to create a response.
Huh.
Right? And that response is then going to result in immunity. Right?
Right.
So basically, we are programming our body to deal with the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. This is a step change because actually this technology, as far as I understand, again, with lots of caveats here of what I understand, was being developed largely for cancer.
Right.
Right. And at a very high level, if you think about cancer is basically body cells gone haywire.
Yeah.
In other words, the body is just producing cells at a rapid rate. All you need to do, if you think about it at a very, very thick, you know, 60,000 feet view, all you want to do is tell your body to not produce those cells.
Just switch off that process.
You know, that extra process that's got haywire, right?
Yeah, right
the
right.
process that's gone mad.
Yeah.
So we should be able to tell our DNA and RNA somehow to switch that process off.
Right.
That is where this research started. And they have found that this actually really works well for coronavirus.
That's really
right?
cool.
The other cool thing about this is viruses mutate over time, and every year we have to find the variant.
Mm.
Then you have to make these things, put them in a vial.
Mm. Mm.
Here you just change the information, the message that you're going to send.
Very cool, isn't it?
Right? So this is a step change because maybe what we needed a pandemic.
Mm.
Who give this technology has been under development, lots of scientific papers, lots of companies working on it for ages. Maybe we needed a pandemic to actually bring this technology forward. This is like, you know, could be a step change for all these bad diseases for which, you know, people go through chemotherapy and then eventually die. That actually,
it's a cool future, right? I have cancer. Yeah. I'm going to go and have this particular therapy and it will stop the cancer growing. I mean, it is the pipe dream, but maybe, as you say, the fact that we've got billions and billions and billions of dollars being spent on this particular virus helps that technology just proceed faster than it would have otherwise.
Exactly. And then the other thing, there's some cool, I'm not going to go into the cool story of, so we should clarify this. So we're talking about Pfizer here, but we shouldn't forget that the technology was invented by BioNTech in Germany by two husband-wife pair.
Nice.
They have a history of actually previously commercializing technologies. They're among the 100 richest people in Germany. And they basically have this deal with Pfizer because Pfizer has the other stuff that you need to actually, you know, do the
right.
do the run the trials, then distribute it. There is some distribution challenges because of the cold. This needs to be at minus 50 degrees Celsius or something like that to be actually distributed. So there is a cold change that needs you need, which raises a lot of interesting questions, right? So, you know, the Australian government can secure the cold chain to get the virus, the vaccine delivered here.
Yeah.
What about developing countries where, you know, you don't have cold freezers, right? So you so there's that challenge. There's a lot of challenges involved with this technology because it's very early stage. The other good news with this one is that this is not the only, and this is what the inventors of the, or the BioNTech founders have said, that they're likely not only the only ones, right? Mm. The other one, Moderna, which is developing another mRNA vaccine, is likely going to be able to produce it. So I think I like the fact that it's just a step change. It's cool. It's a huge technology, you know, step change, and you know it takes us forward.
Super cool, mate. Let's go really left field. There's an article in all the big papers today. Obviously, Fortescue's done well with its press releases because all the big papers have picked it up. And again, we're doing this on Thursday the 12th. Twiggy and Fortescue, Twiggy is Andrew Forrest, of course, going into renewable energy. And apparently, I saw a number that Twiggy wants, that the projects that he has planned is going to produce something like 4 or 5 times the amount of energy currently in the Australian national energy grid. So if that seems large, that is very, very, very large. Now, I'm a bit of a Twiggy fan. People have issues with him personally and for a whole lot of different social reasons. I don't want to get into it. But he has built Fortescue. Given the size of the iron ore business and given the fact that the Giants win, BHP, Rio, Vale were the big three, for Twiggy to have created a business effectively from close enough to scratch and be among those big four, or now including Fortescue, is just phenomenal. I think when we talk about celebrating Australian success, Twiggy should be up there again with his flaws, but up there as one of the you know great success stories of the last 20 years. He's in a whole lot of things. He's in some social movements around helping Indigenous people get to work. He's been involved in some of the COVID recovery planning stuff. This is different though. This is for profit. This is Fortescue itself saying we want to go and make money producing renewable energy. And I thought this was worth talking about for a couple of reasons. Occasional listeners might know you like a little company called Tesla. Maybe listeners haven't heard of it. You probably may not have mentioned it before, but maybe you have. Tesla, you've been talking over the last week or two with us in the team about the fact that you know EV, electric vehicles, are now cheaper at a total cost of ownership basis than traditional cars. And that's a step change in itself. That starts to say you don't have to like the environment, you don't have to like self-driving. You can literally just say, ask the bean counter, which car should I buy? And quite often the answer should be a Tesla, just purely on cost of ownership based on a whole lot of stuff. Is that true in Australia, by the way? Do we know, or is it kind of one of those US stories for now? Not just
I don't know because the cost for a Tesla in Australia is very high for a whole bunch of reasons probably you know, but the cost for a Model 3 in the US, and that's probably the world's largest market. So it really matters what the cost is in say the US and China and Europe, and you know if nobody else is making cars, then we'll have no choice, right? And unless we want to take everybody else's cars that nobody wants, right? In which case we get cheap cars.
So EVs now cheaper in the US at least than traditional cars. And now Twiggy's trying to make money selling renewable energy. I think this is, I want to mention this partly because you've been banging on about EV for a while and also battery storage and that kind of stuff and solar. This is, you know, he's going to use a combination of everything. He's talking about hydro, he's talking about hydrogen, he's talking about solar. I think even tidal, I think I might have seen. Maybe that's not true, so just check first. But this is, you know, this is probably one of the larger examples I know of, and I don't claim particular expertise globally on this one, but of a for-profit business going headlong into something at a scale that really suggests this stuff is here to stay. And I think, so I guess my comment / question is, this is the sort of innovation technology that's been coming for a long time, and it may literally be on our doorstep. We may literally see a future that is only months or years away, rather than, at least in the change, we're not going to replace, you know, coal plants with, I don't know, 10, 20 years left of life because it's too expensive to replace them given that the sunk costs already in the ground. But this feels like a big deal.
Yeah, so I haven't seen actually the details of what Andrew Forrest is doing, so I don't have a good handle on that. But, I mean, it is true that large chunks of the cost for electricity today is actually moving it from from the from one location to the other, right? Whereas what distributed does, which in most cases is going to be hydros. Hydros is different. Hydros again also distributed, but solar and wind, for example, are definitely distributed. One of the things that distributed does is it potentially moves energy closer to the end user, which means removes the distribution cost, right? And then you supplant that with storage to deal with the intermittentness, right? So that's the high level idea. I think this is good because again. Right now, most of the projects that are being done in sort of this renewable storage space are being done, for example, by there's a French company called Neon, which has been running these projects in Australia, right? So I think that Neon is the one that runs the Hornsdale one in South Australia. Neon is the one that's going to run the one in Victoria,
right?
So I think there's an opportunity here for somebody who is willing to make that bet because, again, we are at that point. Again, on a cost basis, if you think about large scale solar, it's actually cheap, right? So, probably he sees the economic. Most of the time you can't do social good like that, right? There has to be an economic benefit. Probably sees the economic benefit and sees there's an opportunity to build. Opportunity to build a business. Again, I don't know the details, but I'd say that this is sounds like. Something promising and something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, so I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs and we'll move on. But so here's the Australian article. The Fortescue founder and chairman said the company had now engaged with 25 governments around the globe, talk about potential energy projects, targeting eventual production of 235 gigawatts of renewable energy a year, or 5 times the capacity of the national electricity market. He plans to visit another 24 countries to seek out other opportunities. And here's a quote. Forrest says, after scientific and personal analysis of the renewable energy resources of our little planet, I can assure you there is more than enough renewable energy to, and this is important, to sustainably and economically supply every person on this planet from this time forth. It is our job to respectfully use these readily available renewable resources and supply the world's fuel and power at sufficient scale to satisfy the need for abundant, cheap, zero pollutant energy. Now, maybe this comes to nothing. Maybe Forrest is absolutely on the wrong path, but he's no bleeding heart, wishful thinking, wanting to change the world kind of, with renewables here. This is Forrest saying, A, I'm going to make some money doing this. B, it's completely possible at, and as he says, sustainably and economically supplying every person on the planet.
Yeah, I think so. Like, just like EVs have sort of tipped into that, the fact that solar and wind are already there, actually, the missing link really is storage, right? And right now, it's the scaling of those storage systems, right? And then once you can do that, there's money to be made by just playing arbitrage, right? The peaker plants can't peak up very quickly. Storage can peak up very quickly. So there's arbitrage to be played in the in national energy markets. So, probably he sees the opportunity. And, I think it's great.
Very nice. Mate, let's finish with a question. I got a question on this, a very first question on LinkedIn, of all places. We've had all the socials, LinkedIn finally joining. We still haven't got a TikTok question, but that's probably because neither you nor I are on TikTok. But let's finish with a question from Benjamin. Benjamin says, first of all, can't thank you and the doc enough for your weekly podcast, deep dive into all things investing related. Thank you, Benjamin. He says, a mate put me onto your services, SA and EO, a few years ago, and I've learned heaps and have even managed to pay it back and convert a few of my mates into the world of investing and diversifying their portfolios in addition to their property. Nice work, mate. He says, one of my mates is an incredibly risk-averse guy, which is absolutely fine, he says in brackets. And he recently bought the BetaShares X20 ETF. I reckon that's an ETF even you can get your head around. So it's the ASX 200, excluding the top 20 companies. So company 21 through 200 in the top 200. He says, he bought it on my suggestion as opposed to just buying the ASX 200. And Benjamin says in brackets, got to beat the market, right? He's very worried about investing in individual stocks and as trying to pick winners and likes ETFs for their broad exposure. Makes sense. In shopping some of the other BetaShares ETFs, I came across a geared ETF based on the ASX 200 and would appreciate both yours and the doc's thoughts. My understanding is the gearing component will magnify both the losses and gains. But over the long term, would this be a sound way to beat the market with minimum risk? Keep up the awesome work and fool on. Cheers, Ben. And he finishes hashtag A-team, hashtag doc on the talk. So there you go. Loving the hashtags. Listeners, thank you very much for sharing those with us. I do enjoy reading some of those. So good question from Benjamin, mate. Mm. So ASX 200 X20 actually sounds like a kind of cool ETF, I have to say. It's, again, you're kind of making a bet to some degree rather than just getting pure diversification, but there's nothing wrong with that if you know what you're buying. The geared ETF, though, using leverage to try and maximize your returns, of course, really would have been painful over the last year, I imagine, mate, at least during the February, March falls. What are your thoughts about using a geared ETF to build long-term wealth?
Well, like, you know, with anything geared, right, I mean, you get leveraged upside, you get leveraged downside. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it depends on how it's actually geared. Yeah. Like, I mean, so how are they generate? Like, I mean, to generate double the alpha of the index, yeah, you have to do something, right? So it's a question of what is it. You know, in most cases, it's typically that, you know, writing calls or buying calls, mm-hmm, for the upside and or, you know, having puts on the downside. I really don't know, mm-hmm, the mm-hmm mechanics.
Yep.
And again, yep, you know, it's at a very high level, it's really hard to maintain that sort, yeah, of, you know, to provide, say, 2x the performance,
yeah,
over the long term. So again, I don't know. And, mm-hmm, you know, I tend to not invest in these sort of products largely because, again, they're complex. Yeah. Like, I mean, the whole point of ETF is that ETF is simple, right? Mm-hmm. Straightforward, easy to understand.
Yeah.
And then if I get a product that I don't really understand, well, then why am I investing? I might as well just take the effort of understanding a company, right? Because there's some other layers being added. So it's just that.
Yeah.
But it's a personal preference. I get it.
Makes sense. Benjamin, I'm going to add some thoughts to Doc. I've had a quick look at the Gear ETF. A couple of things that are worth talking about. So we know that they get the losses and the gains are magnified. That's absolutely true. So that's the first thing. And that can really hurt. Now, this ETF, best I can tell, Doc, and we would say to our listeners, your own research, but it's just a straight borrowing approach. It's not options, best I can tell. It literally borrows money, and the gearing is expected to be between 50 and 65% of the total assets. So effectively, dollar for dollar, you know, $2 for every $3 of debt, depending on how high they go. So that's kind of their gearing approach, literally just borrowed money. The problem with that is a couple of things. First is the fund has a management cost of 0.8%. Now, you can buy an ETF, I want to say 0.14 or so, I think. So you're paying about 4 or 5 times the management fee to get this. So that's the first thing. Second thing is the borrowing costs will come out of the fund. So you're not only paying the fund, you're also paying the interest, which is fine because that's what leverage is. But just be mindful that that hurts you. Now, here's the big bit. I looked up the graph, mate, of the GEAR, so G-E-A-R is the code, over the last 1 year. At 19th of February, when everything was, you know, looking okay, no one was too worried, this ETF was at $29.94, call it $30. The ASX fell by about 35%. This ETF fell, unsurprisingly, by 67%. And you expect that, right? So it magnified the losses. The problem is right now, because of that loss, I don't know whether they had to sell some assets to keep the gearing in place. I imagine they may have, because the recovery, the shares are now $21.15. That's still a good 30% below the February high, despite the fact the ASX is almost back to its normal level. So in this case, yes, you do get the leverage. And in theory, you'd say, well, hang on, the ASX is back. We've got, yeah, it might have been more volatile because of that leverage, but I should be back to the same level because the ASX is. This is shown, and again, I'm not no expert in this particular product, but this has shown that that process of losing a lot and making back a little bit, the gearing has not even close to worked on the way back.
Compared to
now doubled, don't get me wrong. If you'd bought at the very bottom, yes, you've done better than the overall market. But if you'd bought or held through like average, you are down massively on this ETF compared to where the market itself is. So that's the, you know, it's easy to kind of think, well, okay, double the loss, double the upside. You know, if market goes up over time, I win. I would speculate, I don't know. So please, this is pure speculation. The ETF may well have had to sell some shares to maintain that gearing at some point, because if they just held everything, they should have been able to come back with the market, because a dollar is a dollar is a dollar, and the assets, if they'd held them, would have been worth exactly the same. For whatever reason, that is still meaningful 30% below its pre-crash highs when the market is getting very close to back to normal. So you've absolutely been, you had a worse downside and nowhere near the same upside. In other words, the worst of both worlds. So I would avoid them, generally speaking. Conceptually, the concept of borrowing long-term wealth creation makes a whole lot of sense. When you can't control the fund, the borrowing, the investments, you know, my general line is get rich slowly rather than go broke quickly. I think you're going to go broke with this ETF. It's possible. Geared ETFs have gone broke before in the US, so be super, super careful. I don't expect it with this one, but I also don't know that it's worth the risk you might be taking either for it to go broke or simply just underperform the market massively, because that's also just simply not worth doing. Anything else on that one, Doc?
I have nothing to add.
Mate, that does us. Should we come back on Sunday?
Oh, is that a question? Or
it's always a question, but it's a little bit rhetorical. Okay. All right, then we're done. Before we go, please do subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes, your favorite Android podcast app, or, of course, you can use Podcast One. If you like what we're doing, please give us a rating. 5 stars would be lovely. Please do tell your friends. I have an apology to make on Sunday, so we'll get to that one. On someone who did do the right thing, and I forgot their question. So my apologies, but it's coming. Of course, who couldn't use a little bit of foolish straight talk too? And, of course, if you do want to get in touch with us, jump on the Twitters. I'm TMF Scott P. Doc is Anirban Mahanti. You can get us on Instagram. I'm at TMF Scott P. The Motley Fool's account is at The Motley Fool AU. Or on Facebook, The Motley Fool Australia, surprise, surprise, or Scott Phillips Money. And of course, you can get a dose of foolishness and some marketing from us by going to fool.com.au/MMM.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll see you on Sunday with another dose of special mailbag foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.